Saturday, April 10th, 1965. I'd been experiencing brief flashes of disassociation or shallow states of non-ordinary reality. Today I discussed this condition with Don Juan. I asked for advice. He seemed to be unconcerned and told me to disregard the experiences because they were meaningless, or rather valueless. He reminded me again that in order to partake of the smoke, it was necessary to lead a strong, quiet life. At this point, I asked Don Juan the unavoidable question. Did I really become a crow? I mean, would anyone seeing me have thought I was an ordinary crow? No. You can't think that way when dealing with the power of the Allies. Such questions make no sense. It takes a very long time to learn to be a proper crow, he said. But you did not change, nor did you stop being a man. There's something else. Well, can you tell me what the something else is, Don Juan? Perhaps by now you know it yourself. Maybe if you were not so afraid of becoming mad or of losing your body, you would understand this marvelous secret. But perhaps you must wait until you lose your fear to understand what I mean. The last event I recorded in my field notes took place in September 1965. It was the last of Don Juan's teachings. I called it a special state of non-ordinary reality, because it was not the product of any of the plants I had used before. It seemed that Don Juan elicited it by means of a careful manipulation of cues about himself. That is to say, he behaved in front of me in so skillful a manner that he created the clear and sustained impression that he was not really himself, but someone impersonating him. As a result, I experienced a profound sense of conflict. I wanted to believe it was Don Juan, and yet I could not be sure of it. The concomitant of the conflict was a conscious terror, so acute that it impaired my health for several weeks. Afterward, I thought it would have been wise to end my apprenticeship then. I have never been a participant since that time, yet Don Juan has not ceased to consider me an apprentice. He has regarded my withdrawal only as a necessary period of recapitulation, another step of learning which may last indefinitely. Since that time, however, he has never expounded on his knowledge. Friday, October 29th, 1965. On Thursday, September 30th, 1965, I went to see Don Juan. The brief, shallow states of non-ordinary reality had been persisting in spite of my deliberate attempts to end them or slough them off, as Don Juan had suggested. I felt that my condition was getting worse, for the duration of such states was increasing. My inability to shake it off produced a deep anxiety in me. Don Juan, after listening attentively to all the details, concluded that I was suffering from a loss of soul. I told him I had been having these hallucinations ever since the time I had smoked the mushrooms, but he insisted that they were a new development. He said that earlier I had been afraid and had just dreamed nonsensical things, but that now I was truly bewitched. Don Juan seemed to be overly preoccupied, a state that was quite unusual for him. This naturally increased my apprehension. He said he had no definite idea as to who had trapped my soul, but whoever it was intended without doubt to kill me or make me very ill. Then he gave me precise instructions about a fighting form, a specific bodily position to be maintained while I remained on my beneficial spot. I had to maintain this posture he called a form, una forma para pelear. I asked him what all that was for and whom I was going to fight. He replied that he was going away to see who had taken my soul, and to find out if it was possible to get it back. In the meantime, I was supposed to stay on my spot until his return. The fighting form was actually a precaution, he said, in case something happened during his absence, and it had to be used if I was attacked. It consisted of clapping the calf and thigh of my right leg and stomping my left foot in a kind of dance I had to do while facing the attacker. He warned me that the form had to be adopted only in moments of extreme crisis, but so long as there was no danger in sight, I should simply sit cross-legged on my spot. Under circumstances of extreme danger, however, he said I could resort to one last means of defense, hurling an object at the enemy. He told me that ordinarily one hurls a power object, but since I did not possess any, I was forced to use any small rock that would fit into the palm of my right hand, a rock I could hold by pressing it against my palm with my thumb. He said that such a technique should be used only if one was indisputably in danger of losing one's life. The hurling of the object had to be accompanied by a war cry, a yell that had the property of directing the object to its mark. He emphatically recommended that I be careful and deliberate about the outcry and not use it at random, but only under severe conditions of seriousness. I asked what he meant by severe conditions of seriousness. He said that the outcry or war cry was something that remained with a man for the duration of his life. Thus it had to be good from the very beginning. And the only way to start it correctly was by holding back one's natural fear and haste until one was absolutely filled with power. And then the yell would burst out with direction and power. He said these were the conditions of seriousness needed to launch the yell. I asked him to explain about the power that was supposed to fill one before the outcry. He said that was something that ran through the body, coming from the ground where one stood. It was a kind of power that emanated from the beneficial spot, to be exact. It was a force that pushed the yell out. If such a force was properly managed, the battle cry would be perfect. I asked him again if he thought something was going to happen to me. He said he knew nothing about it, and admonished me dramatically to stay glued to my spot for as long as it was necessary, because that was the only protection I had against anything that might happen. I began to feel frightened. I begged him to be more specific. He said all he knew was that I should not move under any circumstances. I was not to go into the house or into the bush. Above all, he said, I should not utter a single word, not even to him. He said I could sing my Mescalito songs if I became too frightened, and then he added that I knew already too much about these matters to have to be warned like a child about the importance of doing everything correctly. His admonitions produced a state of profound anguish in me. I was sure he was expecting something to happen. I asked him why he recommended that I sing the Mescalito songs, and what he believed was going to frighten me. He laughed and said I might become afraid of being alone. He walked into the house and closed the door behind him. I looked at my watch. It was 7 p.m. I sat quietly for a long time. There were no sounds coming from Don Juan's room. Everything was quiet. It was windy. I thought of making a dash for my car to get my windbreaker, but I did not dare to go against Don Juan's advice. I was not sleepy, but tired. The cold wind made it impossible for me to rest. 4 hours later, I heard Don Juan walking around the house. I thought he might have left through the back to urinate in the bushes. Then he called me loudly. "Hey, boy! Hey, boy, I need you here," he said. I nearly got up to go to him. It was his voice, but not his tone or his usual words. Don Juan had never called me "Hey, boy," so I stayed where I was. A chill went up my back. He began to yell again, using the same or a similar phrase. I heard him walking around the back of his house. He stumbled on a woodpile as if he did not know it was there. Then he came to the porch and sat next to the door with his back against the wall. He seemed heavier than usual. His movements were not slow or clumsy, just heavier. He plunked down on the floor instead of sliding nimbly as he usually did. Besides, that was not his spot, and Don Juan would never, under any circumstances, sit anywhere else. Then he talked to me again. He asked me why I refused to come when he needed me. He talked loudly. I did not want to look at him, and yet I had a compulsive urge to watch him. He began to swing slightly from side to side. I changed my position, adopted the fighting form he had taught me, and turned to face him. My muscles were stiff and strangely tense. I do not know what prompted me to adopt the fighting form, but perhaps it was because I believed Don Juan was deliberately trying to scare me by creating the impression that the person I saw was not really himself. I felt he was very careful about doing the unaccustomed in order to establish doubt in my mind. I was afraid, but still I felt I was above it all, because I was actually taking stock of and analyzing the entire sequence. At that point, Don Juan got up. His motions were utterly unfamiliar. He brought his arms in front of his body and pushed himself up, lifting his backside first. Then he grabbed the door and straightened out the top part of his body. I was amazed about how deeply familiar I was with his movements, and what an awesome feeling he had created by letting me see a Don Juan who did not move like Don Juan. He took a couple of steps toward me. He held the lower part of his back with both hands as if he were trying to straighten up, or as if he were in pain. He whined and puffed. His nose seemed to be stuffed up. He said he was going to take me with him and ordered me to get up and follow him. He walked toward the west side of the house. I shifted my position to face him. He turned to me. I did not move from my spot. I was glued to it. He bellowed, "Hey, boy, I told you to come with me. If you don't come, I'll drag you." He walked toward me. I began beating my calf and thigh and dancing fast. He got to the edge of the porch in front of me and nearly touched me. Frantically, I prepared my body to adopt the hurling position, but he changed directions and moved away from me, toward the bushes to my left. At one moment, as he was walking away, he turned suddenly, but I was facing him. He went out of sight. I retained the fighting posture for a while longer, but as I did not see him anymore, I sat cross-legged again with my back to the rock. By then, I was really frightened. I wanted to run away, yet that thought terrified me even more. I felt I would have been completely at his mercy if he had caught me on the way to my car. I began to sing the peyote songs I knew, but somehow I felt they were impotent there. They served only as a pacifier, yet they soothed me. I sang them over and over. About 2:45 a.m. I heard a noise inside the house. I immediately changed my position. The door was flung open and Don Juan stumbled out. He was gasping and holding his throat. He knelt in front of me and moaned. He asked me in a high, whining voice to come and help him. Then he bellowed again and ordered me to come. He made gargling sounds. He pleaded with me to come and help him because something was choking him. He crawled on his hands and knees until he was perhaps 4 feet away. He extended his hands to me. He said, "Come here." Then he got up. His arms were extended toward me. He seemed ready to grab me. I stomped my foot on the ground and clapped my calf and thigh. I was beside myself with fear. He stopped and walked to the side of the house and into the bushes. I shifted my position to face him. Then I sat down again. I did not want to sing any more. My energy seemed to be waning. My entire body ached. All my muscles were stiff and painfully contracted. I did not know what to think. I could not make up my mind whether to be angry at Don Juan or not. I thought of jumping him, but somehow I knew he would have cut me down like a bug. I really wanted to cry. I experienced a profound despair. The thought that Don Juan was going all the way out to frighten me made me feel like weeping. I was incapable of finding a reason for his tremendous display of histrionics. His movements were so artful that I became confused. It was not as if he was trying to move like a woman. It was as if a woman was trying to move like Don Juan. I had the impression that she was really trying to walk and move with Don Juan's deliberation, but was too heavy and did not have the nimbleness of Don Juan. Whoever it was in front of me created the impression of being a younger, heavy woman trying to imitate the slow movements of an agile old man. These thoughts threw me into a state of panic. A cricket began to call loudly, very close to me. I noticed the richness of its tone. I fancied it to have a baritone voice. The call started to fade away. Suddenly my whole body jerked. I assumed the fighting position again and faced the direction from which the cricket's call had come. The sound was taking me away. It had begun to trap me before I realized it was only cricket-like. The sound got closer again. It became terribly loud. I started to sing my peyote songs louder and louder. Suddenly the cricket stopped. I immediately sat down but kept on singing. A moment later I saw the shape of a man running toward me from the direction opposite to that of the cricket's call. I clapped my hands on my thigh and calf and stomped vigorously, frantically. The shape went by very fast, almost touching me. It looked like a dog. I experienced so dreadful a fear that I was numb. I cannot recollect anything else I felt or thought.